So I'm sat here in Forest Hill Library, the children's section. I'm just wondering where my partner in crime is, because the last I saw, she was perusing the shelves of 3 to 5 literature, and I'd quite like her to come and join us now, because we actually have a podcast to record. Here she is.
Lowering myself elegantly.
The joys of sitting in a chair designed for a 3-year-old.
This is not elegant.
Welcome to my world. Welcome to another instalment of the Clem and Em podcast with me, Clemmie Stewart.
And me, Emma Kell.
Think of this as two passionate teachers talking over a coffee or a tea, unpicking issues in education in the broadest sense of the term. What happens in school, what could happen in school, and what should happen in schools from people who no longer work in schools.
From all sorts of sectors, what their school experiences taught them about life and what they would teach schools if they had the chance.
So we are currently surrounded by my most favourite things in the world, books. We are in the most beautiful library, here to talk to somebody who surrounds himself with literature at all times. But before we get into that, Emma, talk to me about your week. How have you been?
Oh, I've been minging. I've had a really horrible stomach bug and I am the world's worst sick person. So I've just been feeling grim. And you know those stories that are going around at the moment about teachers hauling themselves into work? And there's one good thing about my new freelance work is that I actually don't tell anyone. I did all of my work from bed yesterday.
Oh, but the bugs still find you whether you work in a school or not. Still,
because I had to get it done. Because when you're freelance, the salary doesn't come in anyway. So it was me, the cat, all my books and my bed, and I actually managed to get it all done. But no, it's been grim, and I don't know. Well, is it teachers? But being ill makes me a mixture. Rav will testify to this: to furious and frustrated and angry and self-pitying.
And I think we're the first as a group of people to say, I've not got time to be ill. I've not got time to be ill.
Well, exactly. I haven't. I'm far too important. I've got things to do.
Like prepare for a podcast
and 30 million other enterprises. Yes, I don't have time. It makes me angry.
We don't. And I think, you know, there's so much conversation at the moment around teacher well-being and recruitment and retention. And this is something we need to take really seriously. We need to make sure that teachers are well, they're well looked after, but they also take responsibility for that themselves, to keep themselves well and be in school so that they can serve our children. But it's just how we do it.
But realistically, Clemmie, right, you're a head teacher. I remember working with a head teacher once who said, and I quite admired this, but at the same time, I can't work out how it worked in practice. She said, I would never contemplate taking a day off school. I'm the head teacher. So as the head teacher, the boss, the buck stops, all of that. If you wake up with a vomity stomach, what? Honestly, are you one of these people who drags yourself in?
That's a very good question. I've been known to drag myself in, and I've been known to be told off by my staff because I've said to them, if you're ill, don't come in, don't drag your germs in. And they will then send me home. And I think it's, in all seriousness, as someone who leads other adults, it's really important that you act as a role model. And if teachers know that if they're ill, they need to have the time to be off and recover and be well, I think it's really important they see that being led from the front. Mm-hmm. That said, I have a ridiculous immune system, touch wood. And in my 6 years at Surbiton, I've yet to have a day off sick.
6 years? Yeah. That's amazing. I mean, but when people are genuinely ill, there are various systems in place in some schools now where in some cases you actually have to speak to the head teacher to explain your reason for absence. And the head teacher, or the deputy at least, is on the other end of the phone.
As a checking process.
As a deterrent, I think. A deterrent to what? I'm not sure. But it's this whole demonization of flaky teachers.
Look, ultimately, we're adults. We have to judge if we're well enough or not well enough to be at work. And I think, obviously, if you're on the fence and you reckon you can manage a few lessons, of course you're going to go in. The children need you. They want you there. But equally, if you're not well enough to be there, you absolutely shouldn't be going in. And head should be leading that from the front, I think.
And there's little more humiliating than being marched off the site by a friend, especially as the head teacher, I can imagine.
Yeah.
But I do remember working in Germany where they had a much more pragmatic attitude to illness. And they used to... people would quite regularly take a day off without any of that shame or Protestant work ethic guilt or any of that. And you'd say to them, are you all right? And they'd say, oh, I had Kreislaufstörung, which basically means disturbance of the circulation, which basically means I was feeling a bit under the weather. But overall staff absence, overall staff attendance was amazing.
That's really
so people would just, if you're feeling a bit off, you just took a day off and then you got on with it again.
And who would cover that? Each other.
But there wasn't any resentment because there was a culture where it wasn't that I'm going to drag myself in with pneumonia until I die.
And spread your bugs everywhere. It's a really interesting one. And I was brought up very much stiff upper lip. You know, if you're not, you know, if you've been sick twice in the last half an hour or bleeding that cannot be stemmed, then you can miss school. Otherwise you're going in. And I think.
Same. I remember putting my head up against the radiator.
100%. With the duvet over and panting. So by the time someone came along, you look really quite unwell. Perfect for double physics.
Did it work?
Perfect. Every time. Much easier with a matron at boarding school than it is your mum, though.
My parents never fell.
Mrs. Mason, thanks for the time off. But no, I think, you know,
Make a difference.
In all seriousness, I think, you know, if you want staff who are well and who have good well-being and who are able to be at work, they need to be able to look after themselves. And that's what we have to make sure as leaders we manage.
So I'm forging on. Thanks, Clemmie, for the sympathy. Much appreciated. A special thank you here. We said we'd give them a name check, but they thoroughly deserve it, to the volunteers here at Forest Hill Library. I think it's important to note that actually libraries like these wouldn't be able to function if it wasn't for volunteers like this. And they've given us such a warm welcome, despite us stomping through with our suspicious looking luggage of gear and things like that. Luggage of gear? That's not English. Bags of gear. You know what I mean? Microphones. Microphones. We know what we mean. We've walked past lovely school students working away. There's a young man over there in the corner looking at the Gruffalo with his young child. It's a real buzz in here. I really feel like actually just decamping and getting out my coffee and getting on with my work.
Been really pleasantly surprised by how many people are in here. And I remember doing my revision in Winchester Library and actually coming in here today, you know, it's half term, it's the middle of the day, and there was a lot of people in here accessing books, accessing the computer. It just reminds me how important these libraries are, and I can see why it's such a hot potato at the moment in terms of fighting to keep libraries in the local community. So thank you for having us.
So the reason we're here today is to talk to Patrice Lawrence, extremely successful author, particularly for young adults. She's passionate about changing the way young people perceive themselves in society, and her book Orange Boy had a huge impact on both me and the students I teach. Right. So, Patrice, I audaciously approached you on Twitter and invited you to be here because you and I met a couple of years ago now when you came to talk to my students.
I did. A couple of years, yes.
It was a couple of years ago. And you met one of my particularly vulnerable sets of students. And we were just having a chat about them, reminiscing about how one of them actually carried around Orange Boy for about 6 months and how they were blown away by, I think, the fact that you weren't a teacher and had made time to come and talk to this lady who's not a teacher, and how frank and open you are with them. So I suppose one of my first questions is, I've read two of your three young adult books, and the topics that you go into are quite brutal, very real, aren't they? I mean, how do you decide on the themes that you write about?
It's usually a mishmash of things that I think are percolating for quite a while. So with Orange Boy, it wasn't actually a book that I thought I was going to write. I'd had an agent for quite a long time, and every time I wrote a book, I'd give it to her and she'd go, not good enough. So you write another 75,000 words, not good enough. So I thought, you know what, I can't do this. So I thought, I'm going to write crime, because I've always loved genre books. And I went on a crime writing course, an Arvon one for a week. I took my redundancy money, which is the only way I could afford to do it. And I had 18 months off between getting jobs. And I was going to write a crime book set in 1940s Trinidad with a protagonist who just happened to be a woman in her 40s. I went on a crime writing course, and they gave us a prompt. And the prompt was, he woke up dreaming of yellow. And there'd been a teacher strike a couple of weeks before. And being a really responsible parent, I'd taken my daughter to Hyde Park Winter Wonderland, and it was so expensive. And my daughter is a real Hackney girl, so she's like walking around going, I'm not paying that, right? That's a scam. I'm like, I know. How much? I know. So we walked around complaining about how expensive everything was and had a great old time. Then we thought we'd get a hot dog, but it's one of those cash machines that you had to pay £3.25 to get your own money out to get a hot dog. Like, come on. So we ended up getting a hot dog. There was mustard, and suddenly I thought of mustard. So I wrote the scene of the 16-year-old boy who's one of life's lovely people. His mum's a librarian, so highest calling of all. He's on his date with his girl, first date. She's way above his league. She's more streetwise. She's given him something a little illegal to carry in his pocket. So I started writing that, and I had no idea that was in my head. Then at the same time, there was, I think, a bit like now, a spate of stabbings going on in my part of London. And every time you read about it in the news, it's characterised as the victim is usually a aspiring rapper or an aspiring footballer. And young people's lives are much more complex than that. So I became really interested in how far we go to protect our families and the ones we love. So all of those things, I think, were percolating for quite a while. And it took quite a long time to write it. In terms of Indigo Donut, which is actually, I think, a bit of a tougher book, about a girl who's 17, Indigo. She believes that her dad killed her mum. She believes that she was little and in a flat when it happened. And she's fears that she's inherited her dad's anger, so she won't let people love her or be loved. And I think a lot of my books come out of a place of anger about injustice. So when I started writing that book, it was when foster children were supposed to leave their foster families when they hit 18. And my daughter was, I think, 16 or 17. She can cook, she's self-sufficient. But I thought of saying to her when she hits her 18th birthday, you've got to go now. It just filled me with absolute rage that should happen to children who don't have family as a safety net. Then at the same time, weirdly enough, Peaches Geldof died of a heroin overdose and her children were in the room, and her mother died of a heroin overdose when her children. And again, I was thinking about how even if you're, I suppose, come from a sort of rich family, that those children will never be able to escape from that because people will always have an opinion online. So what happens if you don't have that safety net? So just really interested to know, how do you cope with that anger and with people knowing your business?
How do you know when you've made an impact on a child? How does that show itself to you? How do you think, got it, cracked it?
Well, her feedback quite often. So when Indigo Donut came out, it took a week's annual leave from work to do free school visits. And in one of them, I was talking about the setup of Indigo Donut, as I explained earlier. And I could see this young man's face changing. And I thought, oh my gosh, you're triggered. Oh my gosh. And being me, I just carried on rabbiting away. And he went out and the teacher took him out and he came back. He must have been, I think, probably about year 10. And then you say that bit, you know, are there any questions? And that's the bit where you wait for the dust motes to go sweeping past with you rushing after them.
Tumbleweed
dust, all of it. And he put his hand up and he said, actually, he wanted to say that his dad was in prison for attempted manslaughter, his mum for drug offences, and he'd been fostered or adopted, and he'd never seen a reflection of his life in books, and he thought that was really important. I recently got another message via a teacher from an event I did for a literary festival, saying that one of the young people just wanted to say that they're fostered and they've never heard of a book before where somebody doesn't live with one or either of their parents. So you get quite a lot of, you know, feedback. Again, I was in Wimbledon a couple of weeks ago and doing a school event, and a very, very multi-ethnic group of young people, of young women. And afterwards, we just had this fantastic discussion about representation. And, you know, a young woman said, you know, though she's Nigerian background, she doesn't want to read Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. She wants to read about young Nigerian or black women in London, like herself. Mm. So it feels like there is a real need and a real urge for young people to see themselves reflected in books in a way that's nuanced and authentic to their lives. So young people are mouthy, they tell you.
Yeah.
And they tell you if you get it wrong as well, but they'll tell you.
And I suppose the next step there then is for a girl like that to then have the confidence to pick up a pen or get onto a laptop and start writing their story.
Absolutely.
As teachers, yeah. How can Absolutely. We start to enable that to happen, do you think? What do you think the secret to getting children writing is?
Well, there's lots of things. I mean, one of them, I was patron of reading at Duke Eldridge Academy, and one of the English teachers there ran a after-school creative writing group. And what was really lovely is that each young person each week could facilitate it in their own way.
Wow.
So I was recently this year judged for the BBC New Writing Awards, which is for age 14 to 17. And I think one of the things that I felt slightly upset about was it felt that young people's voices had been taken away. Mm. So there's a certain type of writing that I think starts in primary school to pass the SATs. We have loads of adjectives, loads of adverbs.
Front adverbials.
Yeah, but it feels like this kind of like literary writing is the only way you write, and you throw in lots of adjectives until they hit the wall and slide down. And the ones that we as judges really noticed are the ones where young people kept their own voice. And what was very interesting was that a young woman who won, her mum was saying she doesn't do creative writing at school. She does it separately outside of school. And that's why she's enabled to find her own voice.
Are we risking completely stifling children's creativity by getting them through these exams? And yet if they don't get through the exams, they don't stand a chance of getting into the colleges. It's like we're caught in this catch-22. If you were to give some advice to policymakers in education, and you're a key voice, what would that be?
So I think there's something really about reading for pleasure. It's about the environment of a classroom that encourages that. It's about a school library with a librarian who can actively find out the graphic novels, the poetry, the short stories, all the different types of books that children can come and access out of the curriculum. Because also quite often a school library is a safe space for children as well. So it's all the stuff that goes around that. And also sometimes it's around teachers being able to acknowledge to students that actually we have to do this. You know, we have to do this to get you through your exams so you go to the next stage. But there's all this other stuff out there. Again, after school clubs, if that's a possibility, you know, there's different ways. But again, it's just a lot of pressure on teachers as well.
I think the teachers feel the same way. I know the teachers in my school cherish those sort of 15, 20 minutes, whether it's reception, reading The Tiger That Came to Tea with wonderful voices and expression, or whether it's year six, who are a little bit cool now, but still really enjoying snuggling up with the book. It's a really special moment. And one of those things that people go into teaching for is not the spag test, it's snuggling up with the book and sharing that joy and that love of words with children.
On libraries, not to get too depressing, but there's been a lot in the news recently. Clemmy, you had the stats.
Yeah, the argument that obviously prisons, it's compulsory that there's a library in every prison.
I
and yet,
you know what I find that must have been, I'm not probably not that popular, but I really don't like that argument.
Yeah.
I mean, I've worked in prisons before, and if you think a lot of the prisoners have got really low literacy, and though they may have libraries, they quite often don't have enough staff to take the prisoners to the libraries. And I think comparing it almost feels like saying prisons don't deserve libraries, but schools do. So I really wish we wouldn't do that. I know which doesn't make me popular, but having been in prisons, I can see again, libraries are a safe space, but also allows prisoners who've probably had a really rubbish childhood, a tough time in life, to find themselves and find stories in books.
So it's a really unfair comparison.
It's an unfair comparison.
I really wish you wouldn't make it, but... Yeah. I'm not going to challenge Michael Rosen on Twitter, but...
Go on, I dare you.
I'm tempted, but 230 characters aren't enough for that. But I understand a point about schools, but just don't compare it to prisons, because it's just not fair.
And surely the argument should be that prisons need libraries, as do schools, and actually the funding needs to go ensuring that every single young person, whether they are currently doing a stretch of time or whether they're at school, they should have access to a plethora of books and different language.
And also, I think, you know, prisons, you know, prisoners are quite often stuck in their cells for 23 hours. A good book is vital there. And I recently went to, I'm actually, funny enough, I'm going to do an event in a prison in next week in Thameside, and we've persuaded, you know, my publishers to send 23 copies of Orange Boy, because the librarian was saying for a prisoner to be able to take away their own copy of a book. And also somebody told me a story about how they used Orange Boy for the prisoner to read and their teenager to read outside, and had a read off to see who could read it most quickly. So it's, again, it's a way of encouraging prisoners to encourage their children and family to read as well.
There's been a lot of push for creative arts in prisons, haven't there? I know my parents have been involved with Winchester Prison, and they used to have an operatic society in there, and they used to go and watch the performances, which was just incredible. And it was just another way of getting people to express themselves and to unpick some of the more challenging truths about themselves through the creative arts. And and yet we know that creative arts are getting squished at every level, whether it's in education or prisons or elsewhere. So I think there's a real push there to try and solve that too.
Right, you talked about your own house and your own books. Can we do a bit of digging? Can you tell us a little bit about what kind of a pupil were you at school?
Well, the very first school I went to was a Catholic primary school in Brighton called Mary Magdalene's, which is still there, actually. I have no idea how my mother got me into that school, bearing in mind that her and my father split up and married before I was born. So how I ended up...
Would that have made a difference?
For Catholic primary school, probably,
What, the fact that parents were not together?
Not married, and I was illegitimate, as you were then. You even had a little birth certificate, well, they'd especially shortened one, because it was too embarrassing not to have your father's name on it. I remember starting at Mrs. Moncrief, was one of my first, what would be reception now, and she put my peg in a boy's cloakroom. She thought Patrice was a boy's name. It actually is in France, so she was actually right. I think that sort of haunted me for years. I was always quite a prolific reader. I remember once we had these weekend books, we had to record what you're doing on the weekend, and I didn't have the words to describe my family, which is also one of the reasons I put lots of different family structures in my books. So my mum and I moved into Hayward's Heath in with my, but he wasn't my stepdad because I didn't marry until I was 9. So who was this man that my mum lived with, whose house we lived in? Couldn't be her boyfriend because, my gosh, she was in her 20s, so she's way too old to have a boyfriend. He wasn't my dad. He wasn't my stepdad. So I remember writing in our weekend book. I have my room and my mum sleeps with a housekeeper. How come social services didn't pop round at that point? I don't know. It's all I could think of. It's his house we moved into, so he must be a housekeeper, like in fairy tales. So.
Did you feel different? Were you
I was a black kid aware? In Hayward's Heath, so you're always going to be different. I don't know. You don't know what your normality is, I suppose. And also because I lived on a street with just really lovely people. So, and I suppose what's interesting also, sometimes when I go to predominantly white schools and people talk about it being a monoculture, I think, no, because, you know, in our street, we had Jehovah's Witnesses. We had, you know, Christians. We had lots of different types of people. So we were different in the sense that it was an Italian Trinidadian household, so it was loud, it was great music. At school, yes, there was some racial teasing. And what I do really remember, actually, was when I started St Wilfrid's, about some boys calling me racist names, and my mum coming to the school dressed in her power suit, which is why I put Marlon's mum in her power suit in Orange Boy, because this is, you know, a black woman coming into a white school, talking about, even now it's hard to talk about racism, but then she had to go tell Mr. Perry, who was the headmaster, and Mr. Perry said, this is unacceptable in my school, I will write to the parents, and it stopped. And me thinking that a headmaster of a primary school in the 70s who acknowledged that this was wrong in somewhere very multi-ethnic, I think was quite rare. And I had not so good experiences later after he left, but I just thought, I still remember actually that teacher who acknowledged that this wasn't happening in his school and he was going to sort it out. So I think that makes so much difference to you when you're just little. You think adults can help you.
Clemmie and I have been both thinking quite a lot about this whole notion of white privilege.
Yeah.
And I'm going to admit that up until 6 months ago, I was pretty complacent. You know, I worked in Tottenham, for goodness sake. You know, how could I possibly be an epitome of white privilege? How could I be suffering from, unconscious bias? But there are a lot of people at the moment, Akala and the lady who wrote Why I'm No Longer Talking About to White People really About Race.
My daughter cried when she read that book.
Yeah, actually. So I'm reading that at the moment, and I'm finding it a deeply uncomfortable read, but at the same time, it's really challenging. What I think I took for granted is 20 years in London schools, I must, you know, I would never say I don't see colour, but I've done everything I possibly can to help with equality and, you know, and I'm, yeah, all of these different things. But do you think that the odds are still stacked against young black people in London, for example?
For young black people, but also young working class people in London, it's just going to be a struggle. It's like they're never going to be able to rent anywhere. They're never going to be able to buy anywhere. It's how do you, you know, but on the other hand, they're global in a way that a young poor person lowest off isn't.
Well, this is what I was about to say, that some of the white working class poverty in some of the coastal areas of the UK is beyond belief.
Yes, absolutely.
Partly in terms, you said that people in London generally perceive themselves as global. And I'm not saying for a second that everything's rosy in London.
No.
But actually, you know, the limited horizons, the lack of aspiration of some of our most, our poorest people in the south of England, regardless of colour.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And I think in London, you know, you can maybe not being a Londoner, but in London, got free bus travel, you know, literally that's such a big thing. If you live in a rural community with like one bus every 2 hours, it costs you £3. I did an event for pop-up projects in Skegness, I think, last year or the year before, and when I was driving back, a really lovely deputy head teacher, I think was originally Scottish, was saying it was so important for pop-up to bring authors to that school because they get no cultural offer whatsoever, to get authors of colour as well. So people who will challenge some of the stereotypes. And I remember sitting in the canteen and seeing this one little mixed race girl who's like year one. I thought, I see you. But also they said, you know, even just to go swimming, you might be able to use a Butlins depending if they can get, you know, a coach. So actually, how do you manage in a poor community in Skegness? It must be so, you do not get the same You don't get authors coming to your schools, whereas at least a lot of London schools, you do, you know.
Yeah.
So now it's not rosy for young black people. And I think there are still, particularly we're so divided at the moment, and it breaks my heart about how we're becoming more insular because generalist communities, because you're starting to feel more attacked. But I think for, you know, young people in rural communities, it is absolutely tough, really tough.
I think one of the biggest challenges in schools is trying to move away from projects that are paying lip service to some of these things that we need to be working on, or tick lists to get through Ofsted, or to make sure you've covered Black History Month, or those sorts of things. How can we start to have such a huge shift in culture and in mindset that actually this change is meaningful, and that young people coming through the ranks will actually feel the benefits and have that inclusivity and that collaboration that you're talking about?
Something about, for me, in books, about young people seeing themselves in that detail, about being recognised, about having that experience that I didn't think anybody else knew about in there. And it's also why I write about, you know, we talked about tough subjects, is I write about grief and loss and bereavement. So quite a lot of the time I put those things in books, those bigger things. I just think, I want those young people to know that you are seen, that there are people who understand, and that when I was younger, I found myself sometimes in books. So hopefully they can find themselves too and know that there are people that you care
they're
about.
They're not alone.
So. Yeah. Absolutely. And it could even just become that starting point of a conversation.
Absolutely.
Because again, I know certainly from a primary perspective, we have several children who are going through some really challenging times in terms of their own illnesses or family bereavement.
Yeah.
And teachers, for not for want of trying, are desperate to get it right, but are scared of saying the wrong thing or scared of having the wrong approach. And sometimes the joy of a book might just be the starting point for that conversation that then opens up the dialogue that child really needs.
But also as an author visit, so again, I have that privilege to talk about it. So I talk about that, but also talk about my dad being in prison.
Yeah.
And so, you know, more than once, you know, a young person goes, my dad's in prison too, you know, because actually I'm acknowledging it. You do that. Some of us have got
been able to do that before because nobody else has been in that situation or said that they're in that
absolutely.
Situation.
Absolutely. So again, it is that gives you that platform, for particularly for young people who have those experiences. And to say that I can be on that stage and talk about it, say, I've written these books, but I'm putting that in there and I've gone through that. You just hope it helps at some point.
What a responsibility.
but
a privilege.
Yeah, I don't think of it as responsibility. Oh, I think of it as a privilege.
Yeah.
You alluded earlier to your teenage diary, and I'm desperate to hear a little bit of it, please.
It's kind of like an A4 hardback customised book.
It's got a fox on it.
Yes.
And some
coins. It's got
coins.
A birthday card for a fine boy's 4th birthday, which is to the aforesaid brother who was actually 4.
And is no longer fine because he held us to ransom.
No, we don't know. He goes and plays poker in Las Vegas. I've got a postcard of Sussex in case I forgot where I live.
Helpful.
My school was a state school, but it had a really good music department. So they used to write a musical every year from scratch.
Wow.
So that year, it was about Emmeline Pankhurst. Page after page of cursive script of how hard my life was, including an exhibition at Crawley Expo. Apparently, I really like the fudge making machine.
This is a beautiful thing. Oh,
so
my goodness.
These are some of the things I know. So this is 1981. Let me just go back to
there's a bit in big capitals there.
I know. There's ink pen for the particularly bad days as well.
Red
pen for different days.
I think so. I think we have John Lennon shot just in case.
Shot.
Like I care.
In bold. Pages and pages of teenage angst in beautiful
pages,
handwriting with highlighter. Yeah.
So this was the 7th of November, I think, 1980, Friday. I've got a bad cough. Dear, oh dear, life is full of so many changes. Steve McQueen, the actor, has died of a heart attack. Peter Sellers, too. Carter has not been re-elected. And Reagan is now president, brackets, a nuclear warlord, brackets. Callaghan stepped down from the leadership of the Labour Party, and now the ballot is between Michael Foot and Dennis Healey. I cared. And I have changed, too.
Oh.
I had a code name for this boy I really had a crush on, and the code name was Daisy. So... Daisy is out. I suddenly feel hostile against him, scared. I don't know, and I don't want to fancy him anymore. But shortly afterwards, I did...
When you say out...
Well, that's a problem. He wasn't really...
Cast asunder.
He was cast asunder. But
not out as in gay.
Oh my gosh, that would have been great in 1980 Sussex. Maybe he did afterwards. Maybe that's why he didn't fancy me. But I actually made a list called Happenings, a table of why our love was to be. Of what this is how we connected.
So organised.
I know. Well, it's very short as well. 9th of February, He came up to speak to me in English.
Oh.
I saw him in town and I said hello.
Oh.
10th of February. He keeps looking at me in English, full stop. Oh God. Full stop. 16th of February. He spoke to me just after French. 20th of February. I saw him as I was coming in late from school. I saw him in French again. Oh. And then three gaps. And then there was a list of why our love was to be. It included, he asked to be in my group in Lodge Hill, which was the English residential. Number two, the clincher. He offered to lend me his wellies.
Stop.
He was about half a foot shorter than me, so his feet would have been two sizes smaller. So I probably would have had
doesn't matter.
A couple of toes.
Doesn't matter.
Number three, we sat opposite. I think, what, the gaping chasm of hell? Who knows? Number four, he stands by me a lot. His surname was so similar to mine. So if it was alphabetical order, the lad didn't stand a chance. You couldn't escape, no. Next one, he looks at me a lot. I have been so short-sighted from the age of 9. And when I was 13, I really wasn't wearing my glasses. So potentially it could have been him, but I'd have no idea what way his eyeballs are facing. But one thing I just had to say, what was quite interesting, was I read this out last year.
Hang on, stop. Is that a picture of you two? Or?
Oh, gosh, we're king and queen.
Illustrated too.
I read this out. Brilliant. And the first event that I'd done, that was a village festival, a literary festival close to where I grew up. And my English teacher came from when I was year 9. And I had two fantastic teachers, Miss Clark, she's now Mrs. Sykes, and Mr. Jones. And what they both did is they encouraged me to read really widely. So I think with Mr. Jones, we did Paul Zindel's The Pigman in school. Mm. Then I went to Hayward Heath Library and read all the Paul Zindels and all the Essie Hintons, the Lord of the Rings. Mm. Actually noted Lord of the Rings in my diary. Miss Clark, I think we did, Zed for Zephaniah, about post-nuclear war. And both of them encouraged me to write. And when Orange Boy won some awards, both of them separately contacted me on social media and said, you know, we are so proud of you. We always thought, you know, Mr. Jones said there was probably about three people in all his teaching career, because they were newly qualified when they started sort of teaching me, that he thought could be writers, and I was one of them.
Wow.
And sort of Miss Clark as well said, you know, I always thought you were going to do it. But also I could actually say thank you to them, because I think for them encouraging me to read so widely and actually sowing the seed to think that I could be a writer, I think without them, I probably wouldn't have done
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I had a student contact me out of the blue to say thank you the other day, and it's the most, it just makes you weak.
So Patrice, we always finish every podcast with the same question, which is, if you were going to be a teacher, what would you teach and why?
Oh, of course I was going to teach English. I love words. I love, I find different ways of bringing in different types of writing. So I would talk about spoken word poetry, about how you can write. So for instance, the beginning of Lonely Londoners, Sam Selvins, that writes in a kind of Trinidadian dialect. And, you know, writers like James Kelman have been celebrated for writing with the Scottish dialect. But actually, you know, Sam Selvin was doing this in the 50s and not celebrated that. And allow young people to understand how exciting and unique and important their own voices are.
I think that's a really important message, and one we can take with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I hope your next event goes brilliantly.
Thank you.
Thank you. So one of my hopes of agreeing to do this podcast was to make me question some of my own thinking and be challenged. And I'm really glad that Patrice made me do that, particularly around the conversation about prison libraries and school libraries. And I really hadn't considered the issue in that context. I don't think anyone making those arguments was saying that prison libraries should shut at all. But certainly that may be how it's come across. And that really made me question what I was thinking.
Well, we know exactly what Mr. Rosen was saying in his argument. We know the point he was making, and nobody in this room is going to argue against there being more school libraries and the school library being the hub of everything that happens in a school. But the comparison, I see what Patrice was saying. Mm. It was slightly unfortunate in that there was an implication that possibly prisoners were less deserving than young people.
Yeah, and I think if that's how it's being portrayed in the media, then that's definitely something we need to go away and think about, because actually the rates between poor literacy and people in prison, you don't need to look hard to find the data around that. Mm. That perhaps the argument should be get it right at school, and surround children with literature and learning and reading and the ability to put themselves across in the spoken word may then reduce the number of people who resort to violence and crime later on in life. It's an argument for prisons in every, not prisons, libraries in every possible capacity, rather than just schools or just prisons.
Although I suppose it depends on your philosophical perspective, doesn't it? I mean, if you've got, you know, any prisoner can achieve retribution, and if education is a way of doing that, then all for the better.
Yeah, but I'm glad she pushed back. I'm glad she questioned that, and it's certainly something I've gone away and we'll need to think about a little bit more, I think.
Absolutely.
If any of this is chimed with you, do join us on hashtag Clement M Podcast with me at CStewartSHS.
And me at Those That Can, and help us carry on the dialogue.
Thank you so much for joining us, and see you again soon.
See you soon.
Bye.
The Clement M Podcast with Clemmy Stewart and Emma Kell. Special guest, Patrice Lawrence. Produced by Rav Vadgama. The Clement M Podcast is a Those That Can production. We'll be right back.